Welcome to San Francisco Liberation Radio. This is Carmen LaSalle, and welcome to the book release party for the book News Incorporated, a series of essays about the media today, edited by Elliot Cohen. This party took place at Modern Times Bookstore on Valencia Street in San Francisco on June 8, 2005. It was sponsored by Media Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to excellence, ethics, diversity, and accountability in all aspects of the media, in the interests of peace, justice, and social responsibility. Media Alliance is based in Oakland, California, and can be found on the internet at www.media-alliance.org.
On behalf of Modern Times, I'd like to welcome everybody to tonight's event.
I'd like to introduce Elliot Cohen. He is editor of the book News Incorporated. He's also the director of the Institute of Critical Thinking, editor-in-chief of the International Journal of Applied Philosophy, and author of many books on journalism, professional ethics, and philosophical counseling. Please welcome Elliot Cohen.
Thanks, everybody, for coming. I'd like to introduce to you the other members of our panel. We have Jay Harris, who's the publisher of Mother Jones. And next to him, we have Peter Phillips, who's the editor of Project Censored. Both of these are very important contributions to the movement in independent media for Jay, and for exposing really, really blatant issues of censorship, which Peter Phillips has been doing for a long time. So what they have to say, I'm sure, will be of great value and import for all of us here. To sum up the book, News Incorporated, it is a very comprehensive attempt to look at the problem of media consolidation, what's going on with corporate America, and how it's affecting what Americans see and hear. And if I could sum up the book in one sentence, I guess it would be somewhat metaphorically, and that's that the fox is guarding the hen house. And precisely what I mean by that, I think, will come out in statement that I've prepared here, and so let me begin that, and then we'll move forward with the other members of the panel. On May 1st, 2005, the London Times reported the contents of a leaked memo recording the minutes of July 23rd, 2002 meeting between Tony Blair and his inner circle of advisors 7 months before the U.S. invasion of Iraq. The memo reported that, quote, Bush wanted to remove Saddam through military action justified by the conjunction of terrorism and weapons of mass destruction, WMD, but the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy. And the memo went on to state as well, seemed clear that Bush had made up his mind to take military action, even if the timing was not yet decided. But the case was thin. Saddam was not threatening his neighbors, and his WMD capability was less than that of Libya, North Korea, and Iran. Nevertheless, if the political context were right, people would support regime change, explained Blair. And according to the London Times, a separate secret briefing for the meeting said Britain and America had to create conditions to justify a war. This was surely the story of the century, the kind of stuff they make movies out of. This is a proverbial case of the tail wagging the dog with a vengeance. Creating the conditions of war, making the facts fit the policy. And to top this, the memo states, there was little discussion in Washington in the aftermath after military action. It was a scheming, lying manipulation of a nation into a war that would cost thousands of innocent lives for bogus reasons and without a carefully conceived exit plan. this chilling theme is one that has been repeated in history, and I just want you to listen to these words. Perhaps you've heard them before, perhaps you haven't. Why, of course, the people don't want war, but after all, it is the leaders of a country who determine the policy, and it's always a simple matter to drag the people along, whether it's a democracy or a fascist dictatorship, or a parliament, or a communist dictatorship. Voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them they are being attacked and denounce the peacemakers for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same in any country. Well, these are the words of Hermann Göring, the Reich Marshal of Adolf Hitler. They might as well have been the words reported by the London Times, though, in 2005. The really disgusting truth of it is that history does repeat itself, and people, unfortunately, forget. But the plot thickens still. This is the story of the century, the most powerful nation on earth duped into going into war. But where was the press? What kind of attention did the mass media, the corporate media, give it? It was virtually a media blackout. And while Michael Jackson and the Runaway Bride were being beaten to death on Fox, CNN, NBC, CBS, and ABC, there were internet bloggers and foreign press buzzing with the story. But it didn't even see the light of day in the American mainstream. There's little doubt why mainstream corporate media didn't report the story. This wasn't a mere oversight. It was part of a systematic takeover of a formerly free nation by a political corporate machine, one that only speaks in empty rhetoric about freedom and democracy. What this colossal machine really cares about is money, money, and guess what? More money. The only checks and balances it really cares about are dollar signs. In a free democratic nation, the media serves as a fourth estate, a fourth branch of government that's supposed to protect the people from abuses of government power. It's supposed to expose government corruption and send it packing by keeping voters in the loop. That's why our founding fathers drafted the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution to say Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or the press. And for those of you who are familiar with Thomas Jefferson's quip about whether we would prefer a government or a press, guess what he would prefer? A press, a free press. It's more fundamental to democracy than anything else. Where's our media now? I mean, the media was conceived from its very inception as an adversary of government, supposed to serve as the watchdog of the people. But this noble guardian of democracy has lost its teeth and has now become a docile lapdog of government. White House press conferences have become coffee crouches with pre-staged questions and even fake journalists. I think you know the journalist that I'm talking about. He has an illustrious journalist history, doesn't he? Maybe in porn. The press secretary has become really a kind of mindless parrot of the government, not an impartial liaison between the government and the people. Mainstream corporate media routinely wine and dine politicians, take them on vacations just to make headway with corporate lobbies. Official government spokespersons become the final arbiters of the truth as budgets for investigative reporting are scrapped and infotainment replaces hard news. Stories are killed, edited, buried, or otherwise sanitized to conceal important details. Editorials are slanted to the beat of government policy, passed off as breaking news. And how many of you are familiar with the prepackaged news that the government was funneling down to the affiliates of the networks? And without telling anybody that this was government propaganda, people were buying it as though this was real news. why did so many Americans really believe that there was a connection between Saddam Hussein on the one hand and bin Laden on the other? I mean, association psychology worked really well when W mentioned the two things in the same breath. But where was the empirical connection between any of this stuff? What was the media doing as well to dispel the myth? Worse, it helped to propagate it by repeating official government sources, dignifying Dick Cheney and what he had to say about the connection. Instead of doing its own investigative reporting, it was simply mindlessly parroting back the official statements of the government. It was cost-effective to do it, but for purposes of democracy, it was a bust. When CNN, the most trusted name in news, presented the story of Abu Ghraib prisons, it reported that Bush was concerned about the abuses. It said he was concerned about it. It didn't say he said he was concerned. I mean, there's a big difference there. If the abuses were ordered from the top, damn right he'd be concerned. He'd be concerned about himself, protecting himself. But the press didn't look into that either. Now, in the aftermath of the outing of Deep Throat, a.k.a. former FBI agent Mark Felt, the mainstream news networks have had the audacity to ask whether Felt was a hero or a traitor to his nation. And there's lots of stretches of talk show news media presentations, people like Chris Matthews dignify this. But what's the harm in it? Well, the lesson learned from Watergate, I think, is lost, and that's the lesson that not even the president, you know, is above. President of the United States can be placed above suspicion. That's really been lost, you know, amidst this banter of anonymous sources, whether they should be used, and whether FBI agents who blow whistles on illicit activities of government are traitors or criminals. This intimidation is less than subtle, and the media message is really clear. Trust your government unconditionally, for it can do no harm, do no wrong. And the sorry truth is that this media messenger, which is supposed to be the vanguard of democracy, entrusted with protecting Americans against government abuse of power, that's the media that's supposed to be protecting us. It's simply telling us to basically believe whatever we hear from the government. When Newsweek in May 9, 2005 published a report claiming that interrogators in the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, desecrated copies of the Muslim holy book, the Quran, the White House did more than just disavow this claim. It actually blamed the magazine for deaths occurring during riots in Afghanistan and demanded a full retraction of the story. Newsweek went ahead and obediently retracted it, and McClellan, the secretary, actually just threw him a bone and said it was a good first step. But then he admonished Newsweek that they had a further responsibility to spread the word throughout the Muslim world that the U.S. interrogators, quote, treat the Quran with great care and respect. Hey, does the editor of Newsweek reside at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue? Yet the London Sun got away with publishing a prison photo of Saddam Hussein in his underwear under the headline, Tyrant in His Pants, along with such quotes as, it's over, guys. The evil days of Saddam's bat party are never coming back. And here's the proof. Well, the London Times, which is owned, coincidentally, by Rupert Murdoch, owner of Fox News Channel, close ally of the Bush administration, didn't have to apologize for anything because it did just what the Bush administration wanted it to do, help to quell the opposition in Iraq by diminishing the image of its leader. There's countless examples of this, and I could go on ad nauseum, you know, speaking about these examples. Censorship, government propaganda, parroting of official government sources, media manipulation, and government intimidation.
have replaced careful investigative reporting as a norm. Things just keep getting worse as the government looks for other ways via the SEC to relax media ownership rules to let fewer and fewer media giants control more and more markets. And this trend toward government deregulation of corporate media ownership violates constitutional safeguards on democracy, on diversity, public interest, and the capacity to govern. And the popular rebuttal that we have more stations so we have more views is just a fallacy, because they're owned by just a handful of individuals and they control, you know, what these media have to say to us. There's, of course, the internet, and many people have said, well, you know, we do have the internet. That's definitely a bastion of free speech. Well, most people really don't get their news from the internet, but corporate control of the internet is really a movement underway right now. There's a case now before the Supreme Court, Brand X versus FCC, which will decide whether or not you can have independent providers of service providers running their doing their thing through the cables, through the cables of the big corporations. And if they're not allowed to do that, well, what's going to happen is whoever controls the conduit can control the content. And so I think there's a very important result that could occur here. The mainstream media can start controlling what we're going to hear through the internet, just like they've done in the other media. If you study history, that's exactly how it plays out. We now inhabit a matrix where freedom is largely an illusion, and choosing between brands of toothpaste, we have this sense that we're free. We still own our lives. But the reality really is that freedom in America is waning. It's not only about choosing your brand of toothpaste. The minds of Americans are now being polluted and programmed with propaganda and disinformation. We've entered a brave new world that rewards conformity to the status quo and punishes divergence, a world where freedom has secretly redefined in terms of conformity to authority. We're embarking on a new age where technology will make it easy for government to monitor us, to know where we're going, what we say, what we think, and ultimately who we really are. The defense of freedom has become a pretext to acquire our freedom. The good name of freedom is exploited in patriotic callings to arms, but these are just empty slogans used by government to keep us as pawns in its own pursuit of power and control. What is fighting a war in Iraq to do with the defending American soil against terrorists and those who attacked on September 11, 2001 weren't Iraqis? Such pretentious appeals to freedom only keep us thinking that we're free. I recently looked at the State of the Union address for 2004 from Bush in 2005. 2004, he had 20 instances of the word free or freedom. 2005, he had 27. It seems as freedom diminishes, he says more about freedom. There's an inverse proportion here. The less free we are, the more he talks about it. This is why media is so fundamental to freedom. Without a functional media, there's no stopping government from divesting us of our freedom imperceptibly and incrementally staling off with it, all along reminding us that freedom is not free, never mentioning that our freedom itself is the very price to be paid. The media may be our only salvation, but it's now functionally inept. Thanks, that's my part. And
Jay Harris.
My wife has a special tagline for Mother Jones. It's Mother Jones, things are even worse than you thought. But Elliot has done such a good job in that role tonight that I think I'd like to spend my time talking a little bit about the independent press movement and how, at least, certainly currently, in part, it's an antidote, and I think in prospect, an even more serious response to the decline that Eliot has so eloquently pointed out. I mean, I completely agree that in the crisis at the core of a political decline is an assault on the truth that the institution in our system that is charged with confronting and correcting that danger is the press. Now, one of the things that kind of keeps me going in the current situation is that when I get up to go into work, Mother Jones is part of the press. We can do our part to respond to that. And let me tell one story that I think indicates that there's some momentum building among a broad swath of Americans, not just good lefties, about the seriousness of the problems that Eliot laid out. The chapter in the book that I contributed is actually one in a series of speeches that I've given over a number of years. In 1998, in fact, the guy who was the editor of Mother Jones at the time had and of course this is in the time when the impeachment hearings are underway and the Monica Lewinsky scandal is in full bloom and the grand jury testimony is coming out. And Monica one day at there in the grand jury testimony cites she has gone to the Oval Office and Clinton is going to break it off with her. And so she's telling the grand jury this, and she cites that on President's Day, whatever year this was, that while she was there, Clinton received a phone call from a Mr. Fanulli. That's how it was in the grand jury record. Well, so the editor of Mother Jones says, well, who has the president's private phone number in the Oval Office so that he can call direct the president on a federal holiday? Well, Mr. Fanulli, it turns out, is Alfonso Fanjul, who is, with his brother Jose, are big sugar magnates in Florida. They're Cuban refugees who have sugar plantations in Florida and, in fact, a large swath of the Dominican Republic. And about a week prior to this, Al Gore had gone and made a speech in Florida in which he had said that that the sugar plantations, among other things, are the fertilizer runoff, screwing up the Everglades. We should institute a penny per pound tax on sugar, which could then be used to restore the Everglades. Well, Alfonso Fanjul was a big donor to the Democrats, and his brother Jose is a big donor to the Republicans. And basically what happened after that phone call, not we know what the content of the phone call is that the Gore proposal kind of quietly went away. There was a state referendum to do some kind of tax on sugar. That was after massive spending by the Fanjul family, among other folks, was defeated at the polls. And so there, sort of lurking kind of between the lines of this grand jury testimony is an enormous comment on the corruption of our political system. And where was the press on it? Well, Mother Jones editorialized on it, and in fact, about a year following that, there was a story in the New York Times which talked about the problem in the Everglades and the problem, specifically the problem with sugar. And they mentioned the Fanjul family and various other things, and they got all the way to the end of this quite lengthy piece, and they still didn't mention the specific connection between the Fanjul money and both the Clinton administration and the Republican and the Republican-led Congress. So anyway, that was a long-winded anecdote, but what kicked me off was I started doing this speech called What Missing from You Is. Now, the territory that I was covering was not something that hadn't been well trod before. I mean, people like Jeff Cohen of FAIR and Norman Solomon had been talking about these issues for years. But I felt that since I was given as publisher of Mother Jones the podium frequently, that this was something that I could kind of pick up on and talk to people about. And so what has been interesting to me is that in talking to people about the problems, both the economic incentives for the press to not do hard-hitting reporting, as well as, I think, increasingly in recent times, political intimidation and censorship as well, is that I noticed a change in both the nature of the audiences who are listening as well as their response to it. And roughly it's that back in 1998, 99, when I was first giving a speech, I would get a nice crowd of people that I think you would all be very comfortable with. I mean, good lefties from around the country, people who were kind of starved for information and were eager to hear what Mother Jones' perspective on these things was. But what has happened in recent times, and I saw a particular moment in the run-up to the Iraq War, not only did the number of people turning out grow, but the swath of the political spectrum represented in the audience broadened. And I think, I mean, I'm speculating a bit here, but I think that has to do with, in part, the fact that people who were moderates, people who were, in fact, conservative, in the run-up to the second Iraq War, you know, it's not obvious that we want to go to war. Saddam Hussein's a bad guy. Okay, got it. You know, he's killed his own people, yeah. That we have to do a preemptive war to take him out, to put our soldiers at risk of their lives, to, you know, wreak massive destruction on the people and the state of Iraq. You know, a lot of people had skepticism about that. A lot of people. And where could they go to find out what was really going on? And you couldn't find it. You couldn't find it on the list. So I think that has created, I don't think that moment has gone away. I think that there are a lot of people in play who recognize the fundamental inadequacy of the media to our democracy's needs. And that is something that the Mother Joneses of the world as independent media makers and folks like you need to think about, what do we do with that? Where do we go from here? How do we take the independent media system to scale? How do we organize to put the brakes on the rampant consolidation that's behind so many of these problems? How do we, at a policy level, institute things that might actually start to create new channels of media? I mean, I don't want to belabor it here, but community acts, community broadband. How do you get universal, affordable access to the internet? That's in play. Corporations are trying to take that over, and guess what? It's not getting any play, and it's particularly in broadcasting. So some glimmers of hope. The Independent Press Association, based here in San Francisco, actually just a stone's throw away over on Mission Street, is up to over like 550 member publications of a variety of descriptions. Mother Jones circulation is an all-time high. We Are America is launched, and it's got 50-some networks signed up. Salon.com is in the top, 1,000 internet sites, and Alternet is not that far behind. People are hungry for alternative sources of news. Now, the independent sector tends to be undercapitalized. Many of us are set up as nonprofits. I think to the extent that we deal exclusively with the critique of the problem and not necessarily a kind of threading out of potential solutions or whatever, I think that can bring us off as kind of whiny and tendentious. And I think that's something that we need to guard against if we're trying to build a bigger audience for our work. But what I see in the reaction of the people that I talk to, and frankly in the numbers I see at Mother Jones, is a turnaround in this.
Peter Phillips.
For this book, I was working a year ago when Elliot called me, and really thinking through what had been happening in the Bush administration and even before to media. And when Project Censor started back in 76, so we've been doing this 29 years now, Ben Bagdikian was just working on his Media Monopoly book at that time, and it came out a few years later. 50 major media corporations in the United States dominate the news that most Americans watch. Well, he's fifth edition now, and it's down to six. And so we've seen this rapid consolidation. And a lot of us in critical media studies and that have looked at this and say, okay, you know, we see this consolidation. What kind of impacts is this having, and where does it seem to be going? And in particular, the Telecommunications Act of 96, which was passed on Clinton's watch, and allowed for literally unlimited radio access, up to 35% in market share in any big market area. So Clear Channel went from, you know, 40 stations to 1,200 or so, and it's just, we saw this kind of consolidation really occurring very rapidly. I think what wasn't really understood was what impacts this had on news content and censorship. And when I say censorship, I'm saying not the overt, you know, behind-the-scenes kill-a-story stuff, but how media is organized where there's a structural interference with the free flow of information in society. And that's kind of our definition of Project Censor, what we mean by censorship. And the chapter I wrote is called the New American Censorship, or it's actually getting beyond that, because I think we're there. And there was a period of time where there was a number of firings of reporters. I mean, locally we know about Gary Webb, where he broke the San Jose Mercury News story on the Contra crack cocaine connection, ended up losing his job over it, ended up losing his life over it this year. And that was a well-known story. So every journalist in the country knew not only that his story was essentially true, but that it never really came out other than in his book, that the corporate media just basically ignored it, dismissed it. Even after his death, the LA Times was still chastising him and saying that he hadn't proven his whole hypothesis. CNN firing April Oliver and Jack Smith over the Tailwind story was very similar. I put each of these kind of cases out where they had researched, documented, had officers on tape saying that the U.S. used sarin gas in Laos during the Vietnam War. To protect special forces that had gone into Laos looking for U.S. deserters. And CNN had aired it and lawyered it and approved it for release, and then the Pentagon just went really ballistic over it. And Colin Powell got involved, they're calling up CNN, they basically told them their cooperation with the military, the Pentagon, was at risk. In other words, we're not going to invite you to the next war if you don't retract that story. And that's a major problem, because as media is consolidated, when we talk about embedded, it's the reporters that are there, they're in the news providers, which are the Pentagon, the State Department, the White House, big corporations, are providing the news, making it easier for them to report, almost as stenographers, what is news. That's basically the relationship. So when we talk about embedded reporters, we're really talking about embedded corporations. And so the big media corporations, Condoleezza Rice, can call them into her office. The heads of all of them say, we like your cooperation on this issue, and get it. So that degree of structural censorship is really what's emerged. And then, of course, Fox's firing of Steve Wilson and Jane Acree over the bovine growth hormone and Monsanto case. And they, in turn, suing Fox for loss of their job, wrongful termination under the Whistleblower Acts in Florida, and winning a lawsuit, $425,000 was awarded to them by a jury trial in Florida. And then it's appealed. Fox appeals, and it goes to appellate court. And Fox's defense is that it's not against the law to lie to the public, therefore they couldn't be fired as whistleblowers because they weren't violating any laws. And several major media groups in the country put in briefs in support of Fox. This was Cox, this was Post, there was a number that did, and they're saying that we own the media, we own the news. If you're a reporter, you will publish what we tell you to publish. If you've seen Outfoxed, the film, it's very clear, because the reporters are saying, the ones who used to work there, you know, we got daily directives from headquarters saying this is how you would publish a story. So this new American censorship is the corporate control of news in the newsroom by top-down policies in cooperation with embedded corporations, not only with the government and the State Department, the Pentagon, and the policies there, but with the policy councils as well, the trilateral commissions, the general understandings of the way that the world's going to work, the WTO, expanding capitalism in the world. This is really the direction that corporate media has gone. And that's the kind of censorship that we're experiencing today in a major kind of way. So if you look at the stories that have been number one in Project Censored Book for the past couple of years, 3 years ago it was the PNAC, the Project for New American Century. And this is the neocons who were in power. We're starting to realize that stuff is starting to come out after a couple of years that, hey, this plan they put out, you know, during the Clinton administration looks an awful lot like what's happening today. And global expansion, forward deployment of U.S. troops, encirclement of China, you know, the capturing of the natural resources worldwide. I mean, this is the plan that they had out there. But nobody wants to cover it. The Atlantic Journal Constitution covered it. Nobody else wants to cover it in the country, literally. And so that became our number one censor story of that year, and still is. It's still not covered. But the military part of that, the increasing expansion of the military, the U.S., not only subcontracting, but Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman being the two biggest military contractors in the country. Today now, one of our stories last year was that they are also one of the biggest investors in the voting machines in the United States. And that Diebold and Sequoia and ESS they're interlocked with this core military-industrial complex, which is using a firm down in San Diego called SAIC, which is another major military contractor, but is the board of directors is also two former directors of the CIA, a former admiral from the National Security Council, and it's a place where if you're in the CIA, you go to retire. And so SAIC, they're the ones that have the contract in Iraq to do the media there, so that this is the television that the Iraqi people see. They call it American television. And you can't see that here, actually. You can't. It's not online. It's actually, we're not able to see it, because it's propaganda. And they just absolutely acknowledge that. So we have this core military-industrial complex, interlocked with the government, interlocked with the media, interlocked with the voting machines in this country. And the voter fraud stuff is a big part of our book this year. We're just finishing up 2006. A voter fraud is number three. Freeman's work from the University of Pennsylvania. Statistical work is there. Dennis Liu's work from Cal Poly is there. And, you know, it's 100,000 irregularities in the last election. 2 million votes didn't get counted. And if you were black in Florida, it was 800% more likelihood that your vote didn't get counted. And if you were Hispanic in New Mexico, a 500% likelihood. And irregularities all over. And in Ohio, you know, multiple districts where more people voted than were registered. And so those kinds of things are evident and clear. And just simply not covered in the corporate media. And a big story now is, it looks like our number one is going to be, this was Henry Waxman's report in September of 2004 about the on secrecy in the Bush administration and how the government is moving towards allowing increased secrecy in all aspects, doing away with transparency and undermining the laws that we have in place to, in fact, request information and that. So we have a combination of neocons with a plan for global domination, core in the military-industrial complex, interlocked with our voting system in the U.S., not wanting us to know what's going on in government, and the media not telling us. So that's the new American censorship. Now, Jay's already talked about moving in a direction of, you know, under that there's newspapers, radio, you know, independent, emerging all over the country, all over the world. We were just had six students at the Media Reform Conference in St. Louis, 2,500 people there 3 weeks ago, they turned away people. There would have been a lot more. It was an incredible experience. My students were really jazzed, very excited, want to do more on our website, want to really be involved. And so that was encouraging. So I brought copies. There's a North Bay Progressive. That's just a little one up here in the North Bay that my students and I are involved with, and a lot of community activists up there. It's a monthly independent news you didn't see in the New York Times own paper in our area. And that's those sorts of things are happening all over. So in that sense, Jay and Elliot, there's a lot going on. We're optimistic. We're on a roll, I think. And that's what the headline said, media reform movement comes alive in St. Louis. Well, it's alive and well and moving.
San Francisco Liberation Radio is a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week internet radio station found at www.liberationradio.net. This is Carmen LaSalle. Thanks for listening.